Yeah, they have been to. They met the aftermarkets team, so they met Mr. Dash at, and they saw the experience center, and they went to suspensions R&D and E93 plant, and also the clutch plant.
So you must have got a flavor that what endurance is all about as far as our products are concerned, and testing facilities and product profile. And so I'll be more than happy to ask, you know, answer any questions which you may have on our facilities or on our business model or whatever.
I think, you know, one common topic that everybody has on their mind is that on die casting specifically, people wanted to understand that when we are moving towards electric vehicle, how this business of ours will change when we compare die casting which are used in ICE vehicle versus electric vehicle, number of components, you know, the weight, the value of those, how will it change?
Okay, that's a good question. I think we've answered that quite a number of times. First of all, die casting components which go into ICE are engine components, primarily of crankcases, LH, RH, cylinder blocks, cylinder head, cover L, cover R. So approximately 7 components are there. In addition to that, there are certain some components which go as clutch components, which form an integral assembly of the clutch. So clutch has got hub wheel housing and some friction plates and so on. So that's what goes into the IC engine. Now when we come to EV, the clutch goes out because there's no engine, you know, you don't need anything to engage or disengage the gears or something, so clutch goes out. So those three little castings, they're very little castings, you know, maybe 110 dia or 120 dia diameter of size with some friction plates. Friction plates are the key elements which engage and disengage a clutch. But they're very small elements, 110 dia, maybe 3.5 mm in thickness and 20 to 25 grams in weight. So since you have asked a question related to die casting, I'm relating this to weight so that you can get an understanding that I don't lose much on the weight of the casting. Although the friction plates will keep on continuing because we've got motorcycles, the first displacement that is going to happen in scooters, we've got motorcycles. These friction plates are mainly for motorcycles. So I'm just giving an overall picture of that. So coming back to this casting, so in IC engine, there are 7 castings, whereas in two-wheeler this thing, there are 9 castings. So we call them as battery upper, battery housing upper, lower, we've got a motor control unit, we've got an upper plate, we've got a lower plate. Likewise, there are 9 components. Weight-wise, there would be probably a bit more, you know, as far as the weight is concerned, because the number of castings are, but light, if I take the overall light weighting, yes, they're lighter than, they're just about, you know, just about the same. You know, there can be some casting which are a bit more or less. Weight-wise, I would say comparable. So I don't lose much. It's only the configuration of the casting changes. The battery housing is more of a rectangular thing, whereas engines, they're more of a cylindrical things, like a cylinder head, you know, itself. The name nomenclature itself is reflecting that it's a cylindrical barrel in which the piston moves. So this is the basic change in the castings. So we don't see any disruption on volume as far as number of castings are concerned. Number of castings would be probably a bit more in scooters or motorcycles for that matter. But as far as the engine part is concerned, the clutch will go out. This is the basic difference.
So in the die-casting business, we have a clientele, all the OEMs. But when you're talking about battery housing, the customer might change. So, and what is the approach followed by the battery companies for battery housing? Are they looking at the traditional vendors? Are they looking to do something in-house? So the competition in that, how that is versus ICE?
That's a good question. See, first of all, we must all understand that right now everybody is into the foray of EV business, right? I was just looking into a series where I saw many, many, many numbers, you know, approximately 40 of them trying to make EVs, right? Good for everyone, the market is expanding and all. But when we come to battery housing as a specific, they would obviously want to go with those people who've got experience, because these are not small castings. They're not, simple castings. They are precision, they require high precision machining, and the method in which this has got to be handled is a bit different, because there will be many more, you know, there will be some mountings which will be holding, so that there is minimum of minimum vibrations. It has to take care of the vibrations. The castings may be, in as far as appearance, you may find them, they're simple, more of a rectangular thing or something. It's a U-shaped like rectangular thing which will be housing all the batteries, and then there'll be, you know, battery connections onto the management system, the thermal management system and others. But I would suppose that yes, all these players would like to go with the companies who've got the experience to do so. But to close this remark, I would like to say that this EV is at a stage of evolution. So even there will be some change in patterns as far as sourcing patterns will be concerned. There will be a change in, you know, probably the way it's handled, or whether the battery manufacturers themselves will start making the casting. You know, it's a difficult thing to say right now. But as far as selection of vendors is concerned, I strongly believe it will be those who will be who are already into the business of die casting.
Slightly got confused. ICE versus EV, the weight will remain the same.
Approximately same. What I have is probably how much is a one?
So, weight in EV related casting components, the ones that we are doing in certain chamber, for instance, and then we compare it to the traditional scooter, the weight is marginally lower in the EV. The number of parts is higher in
higher
EV. But overall value addition that we are making is compared. I just want to check on the ICE engine part of it. A lot of two-wheeler OEMs also have their in-house captive casting centers, right? How difficult is it to gain further market share in this overall space?
Which companies are you talking about who got their in-house?
They have in-house, as in they have captive sourcing centers, like TVS, for example.
Okay, so let's try to understand the business model of an OEM.
Yeah.
Every OEM, today every OEM in India, or for that matter overseas, they've got dedicated sources which are, you know, not dedicated is the wrong word, means they've got large suppliers holding larger SOB, and they've got secondary suppliers holding a slower SOB. So, for example, Bajaj, for that matter, has Endurance as a large supplier, TVS has got Sundaram as a large supplier. Hero has got Munjal as a large, not Munjal, this Rockman and Sunbeam as a large, Rockman mainly, now not Sunbeam, as a large supplier. So because they've been historically traveling with them, you know, they've been historically traveling. So capturing other business is not difficult, provided we get into the right commercials. Capturing other business is not a difficult thing. But I don't see any OEM doing die casting captively inside.
So any
OEM has got a supplier who's got a larger SOB and a shorter SOB.
Yeah.
At times 60-40, at times 70-30, at times 80-20, depending on the product that you're talking about.
Okay. A couple of questions. Are you seeing the trend on the exports front, especially given the fact that now India's emission norms are getting at par globally, and they were a significant step down historically? That increased sourcing from India. In India, the India steel prices are $700, Europe is $1,100. Is that something also benefiting?
Yeah, that's a good question. See, business models today are based on global interdependence, right? So anything which is meeting quality requirements of the regulatory norms in that respective country, sourcing can happen from India. But if the regulatory requirements of that country and the manufacturing capabilities over here are not meeting those regulatory requirements, then nobody will buy. But otherwise, I think the products which are made in India, especially with the BS6 norms, are good enough to meet any regulatory requirement in the world.
So the reason to say now that our emission levels are at par globally, the volume that you get domestically, plus then you can add on to the export, because otherwise the technologically these were different, the tolerance levels were different. So you have a significant volume in the domestic market. And then does that improve your competitiveness for the export market, and hence are you seeing your exports
Yes, yes. Because sourcing, again I said, if someone who's in Europe, if he finds that his sourcing is better keeping Europe into it, because these days everybody wants to have more of domestic manufacturing. This is, you know, the kind of pandemic lesson for everyone, that if you're into a global interdependence, what can we do, what can a OEM do so that the minimum, I mean, there are minimum disruptions on lines, and, you know, so although I strongly believe that global interdependence cannot be, you know, zeroed down, everybody cannot have a something like a Atmanirbhar Bharat over here in India, and everybody cannot have their own Atmanirbharta. So, you know, global purchasing will continue to exist, and that will bring in opportunities for vendors like Endurance, who got very strong capabilities to meet the quality requirements of overseas OEMs and overseas clients.
Another connecting question. Are you seeing increased machine requirement from the customer? And does that add to your profitability as you are doing a higher value add?
There are two things to this. First of all, let's understand, a product coming from a single vendor is always better than a product coming from two vendors. You know, if you buy sourcing from castings from somewhere and machining from somewhere, that business model doesn't work anymore. That an OEM would buy castings from me and give it to machining for someone else. They would prefer to buy castings from me and machine castings from me. And that's why this model of supplying machined castings is better, because you're bringing your value add inside. Okay. And obviously, when your value add is inside and you've got a higher value add, you're definitely improving your margins. That's the primary concept. Then you're increasing your, you know, the customer's dependency on you. So that's a win-win kind of a situation. You know, the more the customer is dependent on you, and the more you are dependent on your customer, it's a win-win for both. So increased machining components has got two advantages, distinct advantages. First of all, you don't have to get into the disputes of rejections or machining rejection or in-house rejection or casting rejection. You're eliminating one area of dispute. Secondly, you're supplying a fully finished component which is directly used for the customer, and it's shortening the supply chain links. That's the objective.
So, what percentage would be machined?
Raj, we had that number, no? I think it was around 70% of? Yes. 70% are machined and 30% are as well.
Sir, one broad question. Now, in India, we are already close to 6,000 crore on top line. And so, and in most of the products, we are market leader, like in brakes and suspension. So, over the next 10 years or maybe 5 to 10 years, what would be growth driver for us, whether because what's the overall Indian opportunity for us in terms of market size, and whether the next level of growth would come from the four wheeler side or maybe the non-auto side, something we have to.
So it'll be difficult for me to give you a visibility of 10 years hence, you know, so I can't answer that question, because things do change in 10 years, you know, and the business models are confronted, the vehicle configurations are confronted with, the overall vehicle styling may change and whatever. So I'm not going to talk about 10 years ahead. But I know what Endurance has as business models, that we will be moving up the value chain, like as fast to fully machine casting, improving the product or scaling up the product configurations, scaling up the technology behind it. So our driver would be technology. We are not going to be, you know, depending on build-to-print kind of products. You must have seen that we are talking about inverted front forks, which is moving from, you know, changing from conventional front forks to inverted front forks, which is moving up the vehicle configuration, which is high-end vehicles. If you look into a few years back, or maybe 5-10 years back, it was mainly lower-end CCs or, you know, commuter bikes which were in India. Today, the acceptance for high-end bikes is also coming quite strong, and there's a large market for that, and people are moving towards that. So technology will be the driver, and that's what Endurance believes in. We will be moving technology upwards.
Any other component that you can throw
there? Like inverted foot? Yeah, it means APTC clutches, they are very high-end clutches. Has got distinct advantage over conventional clutches. ABS, as a prime example, we were very dominant players in hydraulic brake systems, be it two-wheelers or be it three-wheelers, and our obvious graduating step was to come into ABS. Today, we've got a We've got a installed capacity of 400,000 ABS modulators, and I'm happy to tell you that we have already reached somewhere around 30,000 per month, and I think by August or something we'll be reaching our total installed capacity level of 400,000. So in less than 1 year, or just about 1 year, if I can reach supplies of 400,000 ABS modulators a year, and that too competing against the bigwigs like Bosch and Conti's, so I think the growth driver for Endurance is technology, and we find space, enough space for ourselves in those areas.
Four wheeler,
yes. We have entered into, in fact, we have picked up large orders from Hyundai, Kia, Tata Motors, now Mahindra also. So these are all fully machined castings. So in four-wheeler, we are in aluminium, fully machined aluminium die casting parts. We are not there in our proprietary parts, suspension, brakes and all, we are not there in four-wheelers. But in days to come, if you are talking about 10 years or 5 years or something, you never know. We may find opportunities getting into proprietary products also with four-wheelers. Right? I don't have a visibility right now, but as the business model progresses further, you never know that I may get into that.
So there's only two questions which I wanted to ask. If you could just explain the technicality and break them down for us. I wanted to understand first is, what is the primer PC difference between an ETDC clutch and the normal conventional clutch? What are the distinct advantages? That is one. Second is, in case of inverted forks, over and above the ride and the pressure, what is the reason for migrating for an OEM to that technology? One is an high-end bike, affordability, etc., increasing content per bike. I wanted to understand, what is the basic thought process?
Good question. Now, let's go into the kind of vehicles which are there on the market. Do you see a difference between the vehicles which were earlier being sold and the vehicles which are now being sold? There's an aesthetic difference. Okay. Rear shocks, there were two shocks, twin shocks, now it's a mono shock. The vehicle configuration ahead is such that it's more sporty, it's more of a motorcycle which is used for individuals, and maybe it's not a scooter or something which is used for which is used for a family. So motorcycle is not it's a sporty and adventurous look rather than a conventional commuter bike. So of course the both of them will coexist, but to answer your question, that the technology is moving upwards, and if at all the vehicle configurations finally evolve to the ones that we are going to see now, then on that you can only see conventional inverted front forks, because the right handling is easier, the comfort is better, and if you want adjustments, those adjustments will largely be into inverted front forks. Because
what do you mean by adjustments?
Damping adjustments. You can have manual damping adjustments, you can have electronic damping adjustments, which will depend on the road, and auto adjusting and active suspension. These are high end, very high end. Something like 1000cc and above vehicles where they've got active suspension. The suspension automatically changes its damping positions based on the vehicle terrain or the road terrain that you're moving into. So now, just extending that answer. So if the configurations change to what you see today, the inverted front fork will be taking place into those motorcycles which are even commuter bikes. So if you look earlier, it was, I'm just giving you some technical details, 43 dia, then 37 dia, then 31 dia. Today you can find 43 dia was the only dia which was used for, dia is the 4-pipe dia, which was used for inverted front fork. They are thick, big bulky things. But then we moved into 41 dia also and 35 dia also. So that means the configuration of an inverted front fork is changing for adopting into lower cc bikes also.
So you're trying to commercialize it as much as possible?
We will, of course. Means we are the first ones who commercialized inverted front forks with a technology backup of WP suspension, and today we are a prime leaders. We are supplying directly back to KTM for something like a 690cc and 890cc bikes. So I see no reason why we should not be going over there.
Besides KTM, are supplying it to anyone?
Yeah, Bajaj, Duke. Yeah. Duke and KTM, yeah. And inverted front forks, yeah, we are supplying to Honda. Supplying to Honda for their existing model.
This is developed along with KTM.
Yes, technology comes from KTM.
But are we allowed to freely sell it to others like Honda?
Yes, we are.
Okay with that.
I can't be using the exact. I cannot be saying, okay, this is a KTM product, I hand it over to Honda. No, I've got to develop it totally new for Honda or for other customers.
And for APTC clutches also?
APTC clutches are power torque clutches. You know, they, for a same kind of clutch, see, there's a power torque in that, in which the engagement is more linear, and there's something known as anti-slip, you know, ANS, assistance slip. So it's a feature in the bike when you're moving up the terrain, the clutch torque capacity is higher, so it's easier to go up. When you're coming down the hill, you know, the downshift, normally you would find engine noises, you know, and when you decelerate or not, it avoids all those noises. So technology wise it's much up. The configuration of the internal housings, which are internal housing is still common, something like similar, but like conventional, but the hub in which all the parts are being housed are different. You know, there are ramp angles over there. So with ramp angles, you're increasing the clutch torque capacity in the same configuration. Whereas in a conventional clutch, if a torque capacity is X, you can't increase that X. But in an APTC clutch, you can increase that capacity from the same clutch.
Which models currently would be having this APTC clutches? If you could name a few.
But directly APTC clutches, I'm not into any vehicle configuration. They're all under testing, and we'll be shortly on board, very shortly on board. But KTM bikes, they've got, in Europe, they've got APTC clutches, but assistance slip clutches are there with other customers also.
What about Royal Enfield Himalaya?
They've got an ANS feature, but we are supplying. We are supplying not with an ANS. Himalayan doesn't have an ANS feature. Himalayan is with our clutch.
It's a conventional clutch.
It's a conventional clutch.
This is something that came with the Adler acquisition.
Yes.
Sir, if you want to highlight something on Wexler acquisition and what is the thought process behind acquisition and ANS as a product? What is the potential long term in India, domestic, export, 2 years, 4 years, and with embedded electronics, what kind of products you are looking to get?
See, let's go step by step.
Yeah.
ABS modulators was the first venture we went out for, in which electronic components were used. That is the ECU. So that was our first venture out. From there we realized that since we are into ABS modulators, tomorrow the modulator itself requirement may change, right? The vehicle demand on different kind of calibrations may change. Of course, that can be done through a calibration in the software, but these embedded electronics have to all talk to each other when they get onto a vehicle. Okay, so in order to be able to supply products like electronic damping, electronic brakes, and it is ABS modulator. In case of APTC clutches, you can have electronic actuation also. So since the electronic part is going to increase on vehicle applications, getting into embedded electronics was a primary requirement now. So that's why it was important for us. And then all the EVs which are coming in, they've got large part of electronics. So it was very important for us to get into the electronics part. Now, Maxwell, for that matter, it's a company which is primarily embedded electronics, with BMS being their flagship product. Okay. So this is, and now we are still at the integration stage between their team, our team, and into active discussion. So how would we go further and activate more businesses now? That is a bit too early to say right now, but we'll go on encashing that prime product of theirs, which is the BMS right now. And then we'll go into other applications, energy storage systems, energy systems that we'll go into later.
So, what is the ABS? So we got orders from RE for single channel ABS, but for dual channel, I think we might take another 6 months to start supplying. Or say, but why it is such a long for convert a single into dual channel?
Okay, so a dual channel means what? It is going to actuate the front end of your vehicle. Regulatory requirement doesn't say that you need a dual channel. Regulatory requirement says only ABS applications. So you can have it only a single channel on the front-to-front brake system, on the rear brake system. Dual channel, now since there are certain vehicles in the market which has got front and rear wheel application both in hydraulic brakes, right? So activating both of them through a